Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today is John Carey, Emeritus Professor of English at Oxford, distinguished book reviewer, possibly the most distinguished book reviewer of this age, and now author of a controversial new biography of the novelist William Golding. Welcome, John.
Nice to be here.
Now, let's start with the title of the book. You've called it William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies. Now, I can see Golding turning in his grave at that title.
I'm afraid you're quite right. And that title is entirely my idea. Faber and Faber were quite against it, really, to start with. Golding would have hated the thought, and did hate the thought, that that was all people knew him for. However, I found that when I talked to people about the life of William Golding I was writing, I got a pretty blank look, until I said, oh, Lord of the Flies. Oh, yes, of course, because they'd seen the film or whatever. And so, because I wanted people to read the book and find out he was much more than the man who wrote Lord of the Flies, I called it that. And I'm sure it'll come in for a lot of stick, but I think it was right. I think it will attract, just catch the eye of people to whom, alas, the name William Golding would not mean very much.
Now, even this week, I noticed that there's a story about private security staff in Afghanistan behaving badly, and they say they're behaving like Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, it's quite a point, isn't it? Because I think there are very few books of the 20th century that that has happened to. 1984, Brave New World, I think that's about it. Brideshead Revisited, yes, those have become parts of the language, haven't they? Standing for a whole sort of atmosphere. Why has Lord of the Flies become so iconic? Well, I think that it's the first book to take so firmly pessimistic a view of human nature. After all, children, you know, you might hope would have in them something that adults lose, which we would call innocence. But Golding, because he had taught in a school for 10 years before he started writing, said no. He writes actually in one of the unpublished novels that I've read about how the children in a classroom victimise a woman teacher. It's a fantastic scene. D.H. Lawrence does a similar thing, actually, but I think this is as good, just how clever they are at torturing her. And that's the kind of thing Lord of the Flies grows out of.
And, of course, it's counterposed to all that heroic literature, Coral Island sort of stuff.
Absolutely. He wrote the book because, he says, he used to read to the kids before they went to bed at night, and he and Anne had been reading Coral Island. And he said to Anne, I think I could write a book about how boys would really behave on a desert island. And she said, right, get on with it. No, she was tremendously important to him, actually. So he did. And Peter Brook, who made the film, said to me that, after making the film, casting the boys, rehearsing them, going through filming, he thought the only mistake Golding had made was that it wouldn't have taken months for the kids to start killing each other. They'd have done it in a weekend.
Now, you mentioned that he was a school teacher. Tell me a bit about how this book came to be published. It's one of the great stories of publishing, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is a remarkable story of determination, I suppose, among other things, and luck. He started school teaching after the war in 1945 at Bishop Wordsworth School in Salisbury. He was a terrible schoolmaster, so the kids who were taught by him have told me. He used to come into the classroom and say, right, get on with your English one or reading Northanger Abbey or whatever. And the whole lesson, he would walk up and down the aisle between the desks, either reading Greek, he had taught himself Greek in the Navy, or laughing to himself, or just thinking. And they used to try and work out, when he had gone at the end of the lesson, how many miles he'd walked during the lesson, which was a favourite occupation. Anyway, during the years he was teaching, from 45 to 61, he wrote 3 books, and he sent them to every publisher he could think of, and they sent them back. And then he wrote this book, which he called Strangers from Within, which again he sent over the course of a year to 6 publishers, all of whom turned it down, and to a literary agent, Curtis Brown, who again thought it was not worth pursuing.
He was very rude about it.
Oh, well, the person who was rudest was the professional reader that Faber and Faber used, because they sent it to a lady called Polly Perkins, that's right, and she scribbled on the top of his submission letter, you know, to say it was absurd and pointless, reject. I mean, and it was entirely the doing, really, of a man called Charles Monteith, who was then very, very much a new boy at Faber and Faber. He had been a publisher for less than a month. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. I came to know him a bit later. And he worked and worked at it. I mean, he first of all had to persuade Faber's it was worth pursuing, and they were absolutely against it, including T.S. Eliot, who was, you know, on the board. I mean, was really the literary figure there. But he persuaded them. It was worth his meeting Golding and trying to rewrite it. And the letters he wrote back and forth to Golding survive in the archive. I've read them, and it's astounding, because what he does is change the book entirely, actually. He cuts out all you might call the religious part. In the original book, Simon has supernatural experiences. Simon has colloquy, you can call it conversation, but a kind of silent, dancing communion with a figure who is clearly God, the Almighty. And this supernatural experience is referred to again and again throughout the book. And indeed, Simon offers, when in the scene with the pig's head on the stick, it's different in the original. The original manuscript, I should explain, survives, which is how I know about it. In the original, he thinks of offering himself as a martyr and decides he will, and goes up the hill and finds the dead airman and so on, thinking that he will martyr himself and present himself to the beast. So he's a kind of Christ figure in communion with God. All of that, Charles Monteith, agnostic from Belfast, decided must go. He said, "I'm, you know, cut it out."
How readily did Golding take Monteith's criticisms?
Well, it's interesting, and he did protest at first. As time went on, I think for one thing, you see, he thought of Monteith as very grand. When you first met Monteith, he did seem very, very grand. He was very tall, and this limp made him rather distinguished. He had taught himself as a barrister to speak very proper English. When I phoned his relatives later on writing the book, I was amazed these Irish voices came over. I'd never thought of Monteith as Irish. So he did seem a very grand English gentleman, and I think, therefore, Golding was predisposed to do what he said. But he did give way entirely. And he says in letters before the book is published, I mean, he says, "I can't believe I wrote this book. You've done such wonders with it. It's far better. You've taught me to be economical," and so on, so on, so on. And that is what he mostly felt. But I found that when he was in India, towards the end of his life, it would be in the late 80s, he was talking to an Indian group of Indian students. It's fortunately someone taped it, and I got a tape. There he says, "I shouldn't really have given way over Simon. I gave way too easily." And when he wrote his last novel that he was still writing when he died, it's called Double Tongue. It's about a priestess at Delphi who is managed by someone who is clearly Charles Monteith, and who tries to get this priestess to misrepresent the sayings of Apollo, the god, to, as it were, rewrite Lord of the Flies, leaving out the religious part, you know? And she won't. She won't do it. So, you know, he, A, did come to regret it, so he told the Indian students, and B, wrote a book about it where he stands up to Charles.
Now, you've previously written biographies of Milton, Dickens, Donne. Where does Golding stand in this pantheon?
Oh, well, it's been for me, first of all, far more fascinating, because with, you know, Milton, Dickens and Donne, everyone has written about them before. And anyway, there isn't any new material, you know. It'd be nice if you did find a new Milton poem, but it doesn't happen. But with Golding, I had this access to this enormous archive with a journal that he kept for 22 years, 2.5 million words, 3 unpublished novels, first versions on sometimes second and third versions of novels that I knew well, like manuscripts and typescripts of Free Fall, plus an awful lot of material which is just plans and memos and so on. I mean, really letting one into an author's life in a way that's never happened to me before.
Now this, of course, the journalistic side of this, there must have been a bit of the journalist in you that was gleeful about the journals.
Of course, that's quite true. I'm afraid that's quite true. Not only that, I've been trained as a book reviewer, I suppose, to read big books and snatch out the bits that I thought were vivid and good and well written. And, of course, that's exactly what I had to do with a 2.5 million word journal.
No idea it was
5,000 pages, you know? Luckily, transcribed on CD. So I got it on a screen. But it did take me 6 months to read it.
Now, the most interesting thing journalistically is the rape, isn't it? That's what everybody's seized on. Tell us about this.
Well, the most interesting thing journalistically is not only the rape, so-called.
Tell us
but
what the
also
rape was,
the whole story. Exactly. Well, he went to Marlborough Grammar School, where his father taught, and he, among the other pupils there, was a girl called, well, she isn't called Dora. I've called her Dora in the book, and I've hidden her real name.
Is she still alive?
I don't know, you see. She might still be alive, but she's very likely her children are still alive. And I thought, obviously, one couldn't. So I called her Dora Spencer, and I say in the notes to the book that this is an embedded name. Anyway, Dora was quite a cultured girl. She was Catholic, and she musician. He met her really because she played in a little orchestra. They were both playing violin. He thought she was very sexy. He would watch her walking past the house. He didn't realise at the time his brother, Jose, who was 5 years older, was also watching her go past the house. Anyway, in his first vacation from Oxford, first summer vacation from Oxford, he met her, and she clearly admired him enormously. I mean, you know, Oxford undergraduate. And they went up onto the Marlborough Common, and he started, you know, to make love, or try to. And she struggled. She was terrified when he started to get serious, and started to howl, started to cry. So he says he blowed her nose, and they walked down the hill and parted silently. And he describes it in this autobiographical work he wrote later, much later, 1960s, for his wife, about his whole life in relation to women. He describes it as an attempted rape, and technically it was. And although to him it wasn't perhaps the most important thing in his life, to her it may have been. He doesn't know what damage he did, and that's what worries him later, of course. Anyway, she did in a way get her revenge, because they became lovers. I mean, they spent a lot of time making love, and sometimes it was good and sometimes it was not so good. She clearly realised that she was being used by him. He clearly didn't consider her as a marriage partner. And they used to make love on a hill just outside Marlborough, from which you could see the school playing field, where his dad used to referee and games and so on. And so they were up there about to make love one day. And she pointed out that they could see far, far in the distance this tiny patch of green, which was the playing field. And there was this minute figure, if you look very carefully, which was Golding's dad. And she said, "There's your dad." And he said, "No, let's go into the wood." She said, "No, if we're going to make love, we do it here." So they made love on the hillside. Insight, as it were, though, I mean, he thought, yes, of course, it's impossible. He couldn't see at this distance of Golding's dad. And then he went home and played the piano and heard his dad come in and go upstairs, and he looked round the drawing room door, and there on the hat stand in the hall was still swinging his father's pair of binoculars.
Oh.
And he realised, it came out, that Dora had not only said to his dad, what evidently had happened was that he was a school teacher, you know, and she'd gone for help and no doubt said the attentions of men. And her dad had obviously said, you know, something like, "Well, my sons, you know, are not like that, you know." And she had said, "Well, go up on, you know, take the binoculars to the playing field, next, whatever it is, and have a look at the hill. And she'd done it with Jose, the brother, the week before, and then the next week with Golding. Brilliant.
Why did he write about this in his journal?
I think it was a confession. You see, I think what happened to Golding is not his journal. It's this work called Men, Women and Now, which he wrote for his wife as a kind of confession. You see, what happened to Golding, I think, was this. As a boy, as a young man, as an undergraduate, he was an atheist, he says so, completely irrational, very scornful of anything approaching religion, just like his dad. His dad was a staunch socialist, scientist and atheist, Wellesian. In the Navy, in the Second World War, when he saw terrible things, and did terrible things, he thought, killed a lot of people, he changed. He says that he went through what he calls a religious convulsion. He came out of it into school teaching, very religious apparently. When his students talk about him, his pupils talk about him, they talk about him as someone who sounds like a deeply devout Christian. One thing he did, he went into the form room one day and he drew a chalk line round the wall of the classroom. And he put a cross near the door and then a cross right towards the end. He said, this is the spiritual life, this line, and the cross at the start is when you come to accept Jesus. And the cross at the end, when you are illuminated, and most people will never reach this moment of illumination. This is, of course, the moment of illumination that Simon in Lord of the Ring, in Lord of the Flies, reaches. But between the, as it were, between those two then, between the young atheist leading the physical life and the spiritual man, intervened a conversion in the war. And then he looked back at the previous life and wrote about it in, as a kind of, I think, confession, really, a confession of what he had been like.
But he continued to think of himself as a monster, didn't he? It wasn't just
I know, it's true, life. It's true. He does say in the journal that if, I think by that time he had come to realise, Charles Monteith had said to him, someone's going to write your life. And he says, when they write, they will think they'll understand me, and they'll say, tu comprendre, etc. But they won't understand me. They won't know what... They may think I'm a monster, but they won't know what has made me a monster in thought, word and deed, he says. Well, I think I can't see that he was a monster indeed. All right, there is the attempted rape of Dora. There is actually the very painful business of his son, David. David was born in 1940 and was born with a club foot. And Golding, again in a later piece of writing in the 1960s, actually, in 1969, when David had a terrible breakdown from which he only ever partially recovered, Golding wrote a piece of about this, about how he felt when he realised that he had, so as he put it, a crippled son. And it is devastating. He says, he admits how, you know, he hates the boy, how he feels ashamed and frightened, how sorry he feels for Anne. You may say this makes him a monster. I think to be able to write about it and admit it makes him something else.
Now, one of the most fascinating things, I think, that comes out of this book is when he said, the fall is thought. What did he mean by that?
Yes, that's when he's talking to an audience of students about the inheritors. The inheritors, as I said, is about Neanderthal man, and they are unfallen. They're innocent, they don't kill, don't have weapons, very ecologically responsible, and they don't think, they imagine, and they see pictures in their minds, and they'll say to each other, I do not see this picture, meaning I don't understand. They don't really, their talk is a kind of dancing more than talk. Now, that is like Golding. Golding, in the very first book he wrote, called Seahorse, unpublished, describing the seaside holiday with his family, says, thinking of himself, I don't have logical thoughts, I see pictures. And he said about Lord of the Flies that it started as two pictures. One of them, a boy standing on his head with joy on a desert island, and the other the same boy being hunted down by the other boys. And he said to a scandalised French academic after a lecture that he did not really believe in logical thought. He thought there was no reason why logical thought should be assumed as an avenue to truth. He said it's just a self-consistent system like a game of chess.
Now, he wasn't a snob, was he? He was a wonderful iconoclast. He didn't think much of T.S. Eliot, did he? He, in fact, spilt wine all down his trousers.
Yeah, there's a very funny scene when he didn't think much of T.S. Eliot, because I think T.S. Eliot was slightly sniffy about him. He was introduced to Eliot by Charles, and Eliot said something about Simon and evil, which Golding thought was sort of platitudinous and a bit patronising. And at a Faber party, G.S. Fraser bumps into him so that he spills champagne down T.S. Eliot's trousers, anointing the god, as he says. And how he jumps back, he says, with an agility surprising in one so mummified. It's wonderful. It's brushing away. You know.
So now, if you read Lord of the Flies, what else should people read? What is his legacy in literary terms?
Yeah, what you should certainly read is The Inheritors. I think that's his greatest book. It's the most astounding book about Neanderthal man, made up entirely, actually, from his imagination. That I'll put number two, in sheer enjoyment. I suppose I'd have to put number three, The Spire, you know, which is...
Very badly received, wasn't it?
He was very hurt by it. I mean, I think it's a book about questioning religious experience in a way that is, you know, very profound. I think four, I'd put Darkness Visible. He wrote it partly out of watching his son. His son had this terrible breakdown, but was very religious. And at the centre of Darkness Visible is this boy called Matty, who is very strange, but a kind of saint, a kind of fallen angel, it's implied. So, and then I would make a plea, I mean, there are others, of course, but I would make a plea for An Egyptian Journal, which I think is his funniest book, screamingly funny book, about going up the Nile on an appalling cruiser that they'd hired, which kept breaking down. And it's just the essence of Golding, actually.
And are we going to see unpublished works coming into publication?
Hope
now?
So. I know that Judy Carver wants to do an edition or selection of the journals, and so she should. There's wonderful writing in it. You know, I would sort of stop myself when I was reading this stuff and think, God, I'm, you know, the first person outside the family to read this. It's an amazing experience.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing lots more Goldings appearing on the bookstand then. John, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.